Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So a very busy show ahead of us tonight and a full studio. And look who's here, Richard Collins and Aina Nilana. Richard, I can't believe it. You haven't been inside this building for at least 3 years.
It must be. Before COVID was the last time I was in here. And it's all changed utterly. And I'd like to say that a terrible beauty was born. But
I know, Richard, get a grip.
I better
There's
shut
no
up.
Need to call me a terrible beauty. I'm just a beauty.
Oh, except you, Anna, you're a shining light.
No, you've been on the programme, but you've been broadcasting from home.
Yes, from an ingenious device that packed up suddenly this morning. So what could I do? But I got in my car and at great personal risk and expense, I drove in.
I know you don't like using the car.
I hate it. It's morally wrong to use cars except under extreme circumstances.
Anyway, you're here. We're going to be talking about crab spiders a little bit later on. And a lovely lady by the name of Bernadette Murphy has sent us in some photographs of crab spiders on an oxeye daisy. So before we get to Bernadette later, what are crab spiders and what's an oxeye daisy?
Well, crab spiders are spiders that resemble crabs in the sense that their bodies are quite large, the way a crab is. But an oxeye daisy is a large, ordinary daisy, big long stem, big flowers. Sometimes people call it an American daisy because, as you know, everything in America is bigger and better than it is here. Anyway, they grow along the side of the road in all sorts of places. And the crab spider, very sneakily, is either white or yellow or even pink sometimes, is camouflaged in the flower and waits for a visiting insect coming looking for nectar and then sticks its fangs in, puts in the venom and kills it. And it's really interesting because people don't notice them. They're quite small and they wonder what happens to the poor bee who's probably 10 times bigger than the crab spider. So that's what it is. I'm dying to talk to her about it anyway.
I've never seen one. Have you seen one, Rich?
No. Well, I have seen lots of spiders, but I didn't know what they were. And that's I've probably seen them and not in my ignorance, just floundering looking at them.
Well, Bernadette sent in a wonderful photograph of two crab spiders on an oxeye daisy, and we'll make sure to post it on the website. But right now we can go to the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin and say goodnight to Dr. Matthew Jebb. Hello, Matthew. How are things in the gardens?
They are great. We're enjoying a lovely wet summer, which few people other than gardeners are delighted by. But honestly, the growth this year has been phenomenal. We've had a few dry spells, but even here in July, we are still experiencing a lot of rain.
Well, I suppose it is good, isn't it, in one way?
It is indeed. And it reflects in all sorts of insects as well as in the plants. You know, there is nothing better that makes the world work than water. It is the secret of all biological life.
Matthew, my father has an olive tree in his backyard. And when we got a lot of heavy rain there in the last couple of weeks, I noticed that all of the branches were drooping like a weeping willow. And I thought, this plant has got to be a goner.
I'd say that's probably just the weight of water sticking to the leaves. I mean, a lot of plants do that. They do look a bit bedraggled in rain. But, you know, when we look at sort of dew in the morning or after a rain shower and the sun is out, the sparkle that the droplets of water stuck to a plant give really enhances the world so much. And, something like a olive tree is actually the future of many a garden in Ireland. We're going to expect drier summers. I know this year has been an oddity, but honestly, the spread of rainfall is no greater than the long-term average. But we will experience drier summers overall.
I must say the plants in my garden do the opposite, Derek. They're all drooping. And when I give them water, they all straighten themselves up.
No, I mean, I thought it was gone. I thought it was a goner. And I thought, this is so unusual.
Olive trees come from warmer climes and probably don't get half as much rain as they do in Ireland.
Yeah.
So this one probably said, oh God, it's raining again.
Anyway, it's back to life. Anyway, stay there if you would, Matthew. We've got a very interesting question for the panel. And it comes from Colleen McLaughlin of Birdwatch Ireland, a colleague of Niall Hatch. So let's say hello to Colleen now. Hello, Colleen.
Yes, hello, Derek. Yeah.
Thank Lovely to speak with me. You. So give the listener a little bit of background. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I like to describe myself as a naturalist and an ecologist and a conservationist. But in reality, I've just been producing magazines for environmental NGOs for all my working life. So I'm really a magazine producer, I suppose, editor, sub-editor, designer. I do all that. So, yes, I've been doing Wings magazine for actually 30 years now.
Oh my goodness.
With Niall Hatch for about 15 years, but I was doing it for long before that. I do the Mountaineering Ireland quarterly magazine as well. I produce that, and I do a quarterly magazine for the Native Woodland Trust, which is a much smaller organisation, but I'm very interested in trees myself. And finally, I do the magazine called Flukes for the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. It's produced twice a year, roughly, you know, but they get an awful lot into each issue. So that's basically what I do. I do other bits and bobs, but that's really my core jobs.
Well, you must be used to getting lots of questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But today you have a question for us. So off you go.
Okay, well, just like to give three examples which brought me to this question. You know, about 4 years ago, my eldest brother, Eamon, was moving from a house in Carrick and Shore, and he was moving to Wexford. And he knew that the site would be developed in Carrick and Shore, and he was aware of a rare plant that was growing wild in the garden. It's called vervain, and it's very rare in Ireland, but it's not so rare in England. And he brought me up a sample of it to put in my garden, hoping that maybe I would be able to keep it going, as it were. But it actually died. The habitat wasn't right for it in my garden. But the funny thing is that a year went by, and then myself and Eamon were over in England looking for rare local species like Dartford Warbler, Woodlark, and Cyril Bunting, of course, yeah. And we saw them all okay. But we were parked at a nature reserve, and when I got out of the car, I just noticed these plants growing along the edge of the road. And I said to Eamon, that's vervain. And I'd only ever seen it once before, the sample that he brought me, but I instantly recognised it as vervain. It's quite a lot commoner in southern England compared to Ireland. So I was amazed that I was able to remember it, considering that I'd only ever seen it once. So I'd like to just give two more examples. Is that okay?
Absolutely. And you might describe what it looks like too, please.
Well, vervain is actually just a thin, stringy little flower. It's nothing special at all. It's very thin, quite stringy, tiny little flowers. It's not like what you'd call a beautiful wild flower, although most wildflowers are beautiful. There's nothing particularly interesting about it. It just looks different. But then anyway, I was on a nature walk with the Native Woodland Trust this summer, and somebody said, Colleen, what's that flower there? And I said, that's black medic, which is a flower in the clover family, small flower. And then I was wondering afterwards, gosh, you know, how do I know for sure that that's black medic? So I took a photograph of it and I checked it out, and I found out, yes, it was black medic. Okay. And one of the things about the black medic is that the leaflet, the main leaflet, has a tiny little spike on it. And I was just wondering, what on earth would that be for, you know? So anyway, the third example was more recently yet again. I was walking on the West Pier. I frequently walk there, and I noticed this flower. It's in the mustard family. This one, it's called hedge mustard. Again, it's not a flower that you would regard as a beautiful flower. It's quite ordinary, but it has a distinctive shape. So I can recognise it immediately when I see it. And that's when it occurred to me to ask the question, why do wildflowers have such a distinctive look that we humans, you know, can instantly recognise them, and yet the flowers themselves, because they have no eyes, they can't recognise each other? So this is the strange thought that I had, sort of thinking outside the box, and I was trying to think of what it could possibly be. So I have a few ideas myself, but maybe your panellists would like to get in, or what do you think?
I think that's a very good idea. Let's start with Matthew Jebb. Matthew.
Well, I think this is a fantastic question, and it really underlines our interactions with the natural world, that of course we can recognise different things, but not because they want to be recognised. It's a human excitement of categorising things. It is important for us because we want to be able to talk about a plant like the vervain. You're talking about a plant there. You tell us the name and suddenly all of us are aware of what you're talking about, in the same way that we might talk about different breeds of dog or sheep, cattle. Straight away, it brings the image up for others around us. Now, I think some of that examples you've just given us are great because they do demonstrate how easy it is to tell things apart. And in the bird world, for example, we're aware of things like chiffchaff, willow warbler, almost identical looking birds, but their song is different. And in the mammal world, we have this wonderful example about 20 years ago, when suddenly European mammalogists became aware that there were two kinds of pipistrel bats. Prior to that, everyone had lumped them together. And it's only when these bat detectors came along, we realized that there were actually some bats speaking in a much higher, you know, tone. So they were called soprano bats. And the other little pipistrel was left as a pipistrel bat. So it's segregated these things on something different. So, you know, what you're saying there, Colleen, is, yeah, you can look at two plants, tell them apart. And the question is, why is that? And I would sort of counter that by saying, well, when we come to grasses, sedges and rushes, actually, they all look horribly similar to people who are not familiar with plants. And when they're not actually in bloom or carrying fruits, they can be extremely hard to tell apart. You've really got to have a tremendous amount of experience to distinguish the different species. So some species are very hard to tell apart until their defining characteristic. It might be the flower appears, or we hear their song, or their speech in the case of the pipistrel bat, and suddenly we realise that we are actually looking at two different species, but they looked so similar. In a sense, we often refer to them as cryptic species. They're hidden until we know what to look for.
I have several opinions on this matter as well. But the first opinion is, Colleen, what do you mean calling flowers beautiful and not beautiful? I mean, you said the poor old mustard wasn't much good and you didn't even say what colour the vervain was. That's not fair to be saying they're beautiful. Do flowers have to be beautiful? I mean, is that what their job in life is? I mean, the reason why they have flowers is their reproductive part, and that's where your pollen and the pollen in the flowers is brought by insects from one to another. So the insects have to know where they're going. There's no point in going from a daisy to a hedge moss to the pollen won't be any good. So they look the same so that they can be pollinated and they come out at the same time. And in fact, there's been work been done on how an insect knows whether or not the nectar has been taken from the flower. There's different charges in that, so a bee isn't wasting its time going into a flower for nectar or for pollen when it's already been taken away. So there's a huge sophistication in the flowers, whether they look nice or not. I mean, the ones that Matthew is speaking of, the grasses and the sedges, they're wind pollinated, so they just let it all hang out and it's blown off in the wind. So there's no the wind has no eyes and doesn't see what it's doing, but the insects most certainly do.
That was one of my thoughts, that you know, it's handy for flowers to have a distinct identity, because then when they're in flower, the pollinators will go to one. If they find honey nectar there, then they will look for other samples of the same species. So that was one of the reasons I thought that they do have this distinct identity. But could I just quickly go back to what you were saying there about wildflowers and their beauty and stuff? I had another point that I was going to make, is that I think that most wildflowers are beautiful, you know? Like the ones that, I'm not talking about now the really, really hard to identify grasses and stuff. I'm talking about your general wildflower that you see out in the countryside. There are very few that you could say are not beautiful. Do you remember I was saying that, you know, you can tell flowers instantly by their shape or their structure and features like that. But I was wondering, so why are they beautiful? And I thought, what possible reason could there be for that? And I was thinking, maybe it's not that the flowers are beautiful. Maybe they have ended up looking beautiful, but that it's only us humans who see them as beautiful because we are programmed to identify them you know, for our own benefit, you know, so that we recognise them and take an interest in them. Because when we were hunter-gatherers, we would go out looking for specific plants to gather. And so maybe over the years that we started to see that plants were beautiful, you know, because that's just our perception of what beauty is. So that was another idea that I had. What do you think of that? Anyone?
Well, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Old time he is a-flying. Now, what is a display all about? It's usually about getting a suitable sexual partner in order to transfer your genes onto the next generation. Now, it seems to me, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a plant. If I were a chiffchaff or a willow warbler that Matthew mentioned, it would be straightforward. I would broadcast the chiffchaff song and a mate hopefully would show up because it recognises the song. Now, if I'm a bird or if I'm a flower, then it's rather more subtle now. Suppose I'm a foxglove. Well, I want to attract pollinators in so that they will take my pollen to the next flower. That is what the primary thing is, to identify myself as a foxglove or whatever I am. But there is a higher order here. I don't want any old bumblebee to come in. I want it to carry the nectar to my own kind, or the pollen to my own kind of flower. I don't want the bumblebee hopping from flower to flower and wasting all my valuable nectar and pollen where it's not going to produce anything. I want it to go from me, a foxglove, to another foxglove. That's the first order. Then I will be able to promulgate my genes. But there's a higher order here. How do I ensure that the bumblebee goes to a well-endowed other plant? If I were a bird, I wouldn't accept any old lady that comes on shore. I'd assess whether she's up to it or not, or whether she's attractive or not, because I want to get my genes attached to somebody very, very glamorous and strong.
Hold on to your horses there. I thought the females are the ones that select the males. Yes, when it comes to the birds.
Yes.
Because that's why the males sing.
That's why the males sing. And the females have an even bigger problem, because they have to be absolutely sure that whoever fertilises their egg is the best man around, because once they're fertilised, that's that, and she'll be saddled with them until they hatch and fledge and so on and forth. Now, if I'm a flower, I want to get my pollen to a well-endowed flower. Not just, first of all, to get to a flower of my own species, but secondly, to get to a flower that's well endowed, that's a good guarantee. Now, is there any mechanism within flowers? Maybe Matthew would have this. I know that bumblebees go right down to the bottom of the digitalis bulb. They go right down to the end of that's where the nectar is. So they will be looking out for similarly well endowed ones. And if the bee that gets down there is a good bee, and he's going to look for another good digitalis to dump that pollen in. Is there a mechanism for assessing the merits of other flowers through the bees or through the pollinators? Is there some way by which I can ensure I get my genes not only to my own kind, but to a well-endowed member of my own kind?
I think the answer to that, Richard, is that what Charles Darwin spotted was that different flowers attract different pollinators. And that was one of his sort of breakthrough abilities to interpret the natural world. So he saw, for example, that a honeysuckle smells beautifully fragrant at night, and it's got a star-shaped white flower that moths visited. So it was, in fact, moth pollination has this syndrome of all sorts of characteristics. And likewise, he realised he could predict, when you looked at a flower, he could say that flower is pollinated by butterflies or by birds or by bees or by flies. And it was an incredible step forwards. So what Colleen is saying there in looking at a vervain and a hedge mustard, he has seen the same thing that might attract a pollinator. So I think that's a very good observation, that it might not just be the flower, it's the whole sort of gestalt, the whole sort of look of the plant that brings the bee in. And we know for a fact with the foxglove that when the bumblebee arrives, she always visits the lowermost flower and she works her way up the inflorescence all the way to the top flower just before there's only a bud, so to speak. And that direction of travel is very important because she's bringing pollen to the lowermost flowers, which when we look at them, we realise they've got their little stigmas open. So they're acting as female plants or female flowers receiving pollen. But as she works her way up, the stigmas are closed and instead the anthers are releasing pollen. So before she leaves that plant, she is given a dose of the local pollen to take on to the next plant. So it's a wonderful insight that the foxglove plant is ensuring that pollen is shared between plants and not self-pollinating the thing. And that is the most important thing a plant can do, is make sure it gets its pollen from one plant to another. And insect vectors are just the perfect go-between, if you like, for that process.
Is it like vintage wine? Suppose I'm producing nectar and I want a certain kind of insect to come and take my pollen. Can I develop a taste in my nectar that will keep the riffraff out and only get the ones I want in? I give them a taste for this vintage. Is there any element of that? And you haven't addressed my quality control problem. How do I ensure that I get my pollen to the right members of my own species and not the ones that are second rate?
I think that the answer is what Darwin spotted was anomalies in the animal world, which he referred to as sexual selection, whereby, you know, the best looking bird of paradise or the rhinoceros beetle with the big sort of antlers on its head, they were the ones that won the females. So the red stag, the red deer, the stags in the autumn, they fight for little harems of does that they are going to mate with. And that form of selection he could see was very distinct. So we get this sexual selection in animal species, but I don't think anybody has been able to claim this of the plant world, because standing alone as a different plant that is more attractive to a bee than anything else actually means that you won't be able to spread your pollen, because all the bees are rushing to this big fancy individual and just visiting its flowers, and the individual would actually disappear from the gene pool. So I think there would be a problem in plants to start trying to outcompete one another. You want to make sure you're one of hundreds of individual plants that the bee, when she's foraging, will visit one after another. And bees are incredibly faithful. They come out of the hive, for example, if it's the honeybee, and the first plant she visits, if it's got nectar, she will say, right, I'm going to stick to the buttercups. And that entire flight that she makes from the hive, she would just visit buttercup flowers, or she would just visit clover flowers. And we also know that they then communicate that back in the hive to other individuals, saying, I found a great patch of clover 150 yards to the southeast.
Yeah, there's another scenario, Matthew, as well. And this is the case of orchids. Now, we have the bee orchid in Ireland, which resembles a bee. And the received wisdom is that a bee is fooled by this, tries to mate with it, discovers that it is not in actual fact another bee, and goes off and tries it again on another one, thus bringing the pollen with it. Whereas in actual fact, these bee orchids are in fact sterile and they self-pollinate themselves. So did they do this once and not do it any longer because the bees weren't doing it? Or why are they like that if we're going to be going with it? Why do they look like bees and be self-fertilising?
It is one of the sort of inexplicable things that the bee orchid seems to have spread further than the species of wasp that relied on, this little solitary wasp that's fooled into actually copulating with the flower. And it was one of the inexplicable things is how sometimes a species gets away from its pollinator like that. And like you say, in a bee orchid, if you look at them in the field in Ireland, the little pollinia drop down and the wind literally blows them against the stigma, and lo and behold, it will be able to set seed. So it is one of these oddities. And we mustn't expect nature to be sort of perfectly functioning everywhere. And when it doesn't function, and we can see that there's a problem, it is fascinating to then understand that it works. And in the case of the bee orchid, it doesn't matter that it's self-fertilizing itself. Clearly, it works sufficiently for the bee orchids to always be around us. And Darwin realized that if you outbred foxgloves, they were much more robust and strong individuals. And if they were inbred, pollinated by their own pollen, the individuals were much weaker and produced a smaller crop of flowers. So we know that inbreeding is bad in plants and in animals. But if it means a difference between surviving or not surviving, in the case of the bee orchid, it ensures that it survives.
Is that true of, say, wasp orchids and fly orchids? There's a whole load of these, and they're very interesting to look at. Presumably, at some time in the past, they did need these pollinators to come and copulate with them, as you describe. Is this a kind of residual organ or function that is like our appendix, for instance? It's said to be of no function whatever in the stomach. Now, is it like that, something that's left behind? It was needed long ago, eons ago, but it has fallen into disuse. Is that how we should picture these particular creatures?
Well, the really beautiful sort of story behind that is we used to think there were sort of 40 to 50 species of fly orchid and bee orchid. This is the genus Ophrys, which occurs all across Europe. But when they looked at them genetically, they looked at their genes to try and work out how they'd all evolved, they realized actually there are only about a dozen species, just 12 species across Europe, but some of them were very varied. So when they found themselves in Crete, for example, there was a different wasp or bee, so they adjusted their flowers. So the flowers look slightly different, but actually they are all of the same genetic lineage. So there was a case where us human beings were looking at the differences and we said, oh yes, that is definitely different. But in terms of the biology, it appears that evolution still hasn't caught up. They are being pollinated by different species of wasp and bee around Europe, but they have not genetically diverged yet. So the question is, are those species because us humans can spot the difference, or are they not species because genetically they still haven't turned into anything different from their sort of great-great-great-grandparents? So it's a fascinating glimpse of a world where we know the world is full of species, but trying to define what a species is has foxed biologists sort of forever, ever since Charles Darwin first made his great insights into the origin of species. We still can't define a species simply.
I'm amazed by the amount of knowledge that you all have there. It's fantastic. I'm learning a lot. I did have another point that maybe we could address. It's on the same topic. By being identifiable and recognizable to insects and to people, plants are setting themselves up to be food plants for these species as well. So, you have butterflies that feed on plants. You have humans who feed on plants. Could there be an advantage in that respect in being recognizable, in the sense that, would that help to spread a species, by the foragers, the human foragers, say, collecting them and taking them away? Would that be an advantage to the plant?
One of the beautiful answers to that is, for example, that wheat was a chance hybrid on the shores of the Black Sea maybe 9,000 years ago, and almost certainly a Neolithic woman passing by said, that's going to be handy to feed my children, these grains. I can grind them up and feed my child. She probably started to take some home, grow them on a little plot near the village, and suddenly wheat was domesticated and now covers, every year, us humans grow between 30 and 40 times the area of Ireland in wheat, whose origin was just a chance hybrid plant on the shores of the Black Sea. And likewise, the apple tree. The apple is now grown all over the Northern Hemisphere in New Zealand, South America, South Africa. And yet the apple itself just comes from a tiny little area of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan. So our desire for food plants, drug plants, medicinal plants, has been an enormous evolutionary advantage to those things that we have picked, if you like, out of the wild and brought them into cultivation. They now have this evolutionary advantage of suddenly being favoured by Homo sapiens and given them a gigantic evolutionary advantage.
On the other hand, what about the llama's growth on the oak? Oak trees do not like having their leaves eaten by caterpillars and actually secrete toxins into the leaves to make them not palatable. And this is in fact what happens. And we have this llama's growth coming on oak trees in August because the toxins in them protect the leaves from being eaten by insects. And there are those who say, speaking of wheat, that the wheat doesn't like it either. And wheat has evolved to such an extent that many people find modern varieties of wheat unable to digest it because of gluten levels and the like, and they're going back to these earlier species like spelt and the like, that the plants can fight back if they don't want to be eaten. So it's not all hunky-dory, it's a great thing and they're loving it. Some of them are hating it.
There you go, Colleen.
Yeah, well, it's great. I never imagined that there'd be so many ideas out there. Are you familiar with a vegetable called the Romanesco cauliflower? There's a greengrocer's near me, Robbie's Greengrocer's, and sometimes he has this cauliflower. It's called Romanesco cauliflower. And unlike the ordinary cauliflower, the edible bit of it is a very strange geometrical shape. It's just astonishing to look at. So it kind of brings me back to my first question, my original question. Why on earth would a cauliflower have this extraordinary geometrical shape, you know? It's mind-boggling, really.
The way that plants grow has also got this a beautiful pattern to it. When you are, as a plant stem, you're packing all your new leaves or petals or buds inside a big bud, the best packing ratios conform to a particular series called the Fibonacci series. And that Fibonacci series is literally the last two digits added together. So 1 plus 1 is 2, 2 plus 1 is 3, 3 plus 2 is 5, 5 plus 3 is 8, 8 plus 5 is 13. Those ratios are absolutely fixed in the plant world. And it's a beautiful insight that the spirals on a pine cone or the little scales of a pineapple fruit, they all conform to this pattern. And what you're seeing in that Romanesco cauliflower head is this almost fractal-like beauty of this Fibonacci series in every little bud that this huge flower head of the cauliflower represents. So yes, when it's presented in a particular way and would have been selected, that cultivar was selected because of its good looks. It just looks beautiful. That is simply an expression of the Fibonacci series. There's nothing magical about it. It's the best way to pack your three petals or five petals or eight petals into a bud.
Well, Matthew, thank you very much indeed. And Colleen, thank you for starting that wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. No problem.
Now, you may have seen that three lion cubs were born recently at Foto Wildlife Park in County Cork. They are Asiatic lines and they are all male, the first to be born there since the 1970s. To learn more about these cubs and Asiatic lines, we can say hello now to Terry Flanagan, who's at Photo Wildlife Park. Terence!
Well, Derek, you won't believe it. I'm standing here not 5 metres away from the most magnificent Asiatic lion you've ever seen.
Now, be careful.
There's a big glass wall between him and I. But on the other side of the glass wall with me is Julian Fontenot. Julian, you're in charge of all these lions here. Tell me a little bit about this big fella.
So this is Yelly. Yelly, he's our male here in the pride in Fota. And he's the new father of three cubs with mother Aya.
Yeah. So, now, we actually saw the mother, Aya, there earlier on. She came over, but we haven't seen the cubs yet.
So, no, unfortunately, the weather today is a bit dull. So, I'd say she was after feeding the cubs. And she probably took them somewhere in the middle of the enclosure. And I'd say they'll be out later on during the day. So, yeah. Once they have had a lovely nap.
This is her first family, her first litter. What kind of a mother is she?
So she's a really good mom, for a first-time mom. She's we actually went in and checked the cubs about a couple of weeks ago, and they were all really healthy, really round belly. So we are sure she's actually doing a fantastic job. They are starting the last couple of days to move around a little bit more. They are doing everything they should be doing. So she must be doing a fantastic job.
Now, there are three males. Have you named them yet?
So we don't have names yet. So you can actually, people can go in on the website and then we have a naming competition, which will be running for a few more days. So you can actually go in, fill out the form and then suggest names for the three male cubs.
Now, these are Asiatic lions and I'm looking at the male here as well. His mane, that's the head of hair that he has. It's slightly different what you would normally expect.
It's not a traditional African lion, so it's not as big anyway. Yeah. His one even changed since he arrived, which was even smaller than that. But taking part of that pride and taking the lead of the pride, the mane tend to change as well. So it can be different from individuals to another one. And his mane really got darker, a little bit bigger, but it's not going to be as big as an African lion. Norman tradition head African lions.
Now, the family that we're looking at here, there's the one male and there are actually three females, is that right, as well as the babies?
So we have here three females. So we still have Gira and Gita. Gira is actually Aya's mom. So there are two sisters that came from Helsinki. And they were the original lions with Shanto, a male that we unfortunately lost a few years back. And so Aya was the part of the first litter of cubs that were born here in 2016 with Mother Gira. And she had then another litter of cubs after that. She had four females, which went on as part of the European breeding program. They are down in France at the moment. And then we left with Aya, her mom, her aunt, Yali, and now the three cubs.
Now, Yali, the daddy, I'm told he was present at the birth. That's not really common, is it?
So, no, usually what would happen is we would separate the male from the female. In the wild, the mom usually tend to isolate herself to have the cubs. Usually it's to stay away from the other females. Some could get jealous and then go in and then try to steal the cubs. But the males, we find out, actually are not as much of a problem. And he was actually taking his role really, really good, because he would stand by where she had the cubs at the first, and she would, or he would protect or just check on the cubs every now and then.
Now, he's actually coming over to us to the glass. He must know you, does he?
He does, yeah. He knows the uniform.
He's eyeing you. He's not actually eyeing me.
He knows the uniform and he knows, yeah, me as well. So he can hear me. He probably knows my voice. And
he's probably looking for food, is he?
And yeah, he's coming in for the food, okay, yeah.
He's standing up there against the glass. He's a magnificent animal.
So he's lovely. So you're looking at about 180 kg there of lion. And it can be impressive, but it's up close, yeah.
Now, he's after turning around there and he's peeing on the glass. Why is he doing that?
So it is, he's marking his territory. So lions would, we have a territory. So some big prides would have a few kilometers square, right, anyway, of territories. And he would delimit that area In the wild, he would urinate on trees, rocks, and obviously on the glass here in Fota.
So he's telling you, this is my spot.
So he's telling us, don't come any closer.
No intention of coming any closer than this. Let's talk about Asiatic lions then in the wild. Their numbers are very, very low. What, a couple of 600 or something?
So, yeah, we're looking at about between 500 to 600. And they are mainly in India, in the Gir National Park. And the last couple of years, the good thing is they found out that population is slightly on the rise, right, with prides and population establishing outside the national parks. So they are getting a bit more territory and in breeding at the moment, so that's quite good.
But it's only in one location, isn't that right?
But it is only in one location, yeah.
So you know the old adage, putting all your eggs in the one basket, that must be a worry.
Yes, it is. So that's why with the EASA and here in Fota, these guys are part of the EEP, the European Breeding Programme, which is aimed to actually keep a good, healthy, genetically speaking, population in captivity. So we have that extra population that can eventually go back into the wild.
Mm. Now, these three here, these babies, they're actually out in the grounds. They're not indoors.
No. So that was important for first-time mom Aya to decide where she wanted to have the cubs. They usually would pick the perfect spot for it. We gave her the option to have them inside in the house. It's nice and comfy. There's underfloor heating, lovely straw beds. But she obviously found out the brambles in the middle, probably just for safety. And then Yali was beside her anyway, so that's where she decided to go. So we didn't want to upset her and then go against that.
And Yali himself, he's very important genetically. Explain why.
So as part of the breeding program, all the population, so the coordinator, the EEP coordinator, would have all the family trees of those animals that are available for breeding for the program. And then Yali, his side of the family is not as much represented as other lions in the lion, Asiatic lion EEP. So that's why he's really important to breed, as he came here anyway to breed with a non-related female.
So he would probably move on then to another wildlife park and breed with another Asiatic female.
So it could be an option. It's at this point, it's out of our it won't be our decision. This is to the species coordinator to to give advice. We might get another litter or two here, and he might be moving on, or he might be staying, and then another female would come in to breed with him. That's something we don't know yet.
Do you worry about infection or disease here?
No, there is little that can affect these guys. They would be vaccinated the same as your domestic cats, because it is a domestic cat, just a little bit bigger. So they would be going through the same vaccination protocols.
Mm-hmm. What about injuries? Say if they're jumping, break a leg, break a tooth, something like that?
They are fairly resilient animal. And then usually when they are injured, we have to really monitor them closely, because they tend to hide, like any wild animal would hide injuries. But we are doing what we call medical training here. So we can get them inside the house, call them over. We can have a good check over. If Yali, for example, would be a little bit lame on the leg, we can check. They might have a torn just lodged in that we would be able to remove just through the training. And then if any medication needed, because they can come to us and get fed, we can pass any medication needed.
This is a great news story for Fota to have these lions here. And you were saying that, you know, it was to keep their genes from going extinct. But realistically, are they going to be reintroduced into the wild? I mean, the wild isn't suitable for them. This is why there's only one place left in India where they are in the wild. I mean, habitat destruction is making it worse and worse. So what we're actually doing is keeping a species from going extinct, which is great. But is it a realistic proposition to think that we'll bring them back into the wild someday, when patently it was being in the wild in the first place that was the cause of their demise?
So it is a good question. It obviously worked with some EEP in the past, like the Golden Lion Tamarin, or some the Spix macaws as well, that have been released in South America from those healthy captive population. So that's how I am here. We don't actually obviously have the answer with the Asiatic lion as yet, as the Indian population growing anywhere, or human population growing over there. The loss of habitat, it's definitely a big problem. But hopefully with the work of people in the in situ, we'd be able to secure some land and then, yeah, possibly reintroduce some of the lions, or if anything dramatic happened to the wild population, we would be able to supply anyway with genetically healthy population to go back out in the wild.
Now, lions seem to me to be animals that don't really want to be cats. They want to be dogs because dogs hunt often. Most dogs hunt communally. They cooperate and they go in packs. And lions do that. But cats are the old stealth ambush predators that do not go around traditionally in packs. Now, I understand that your Asiatic lion is far less inclined to form large brides than these African equivalent. He seems to be going back to the old ways of his ancestors and becoming monogamous and staying with the one person all the time sort of thing. And he's smaller and so forth. It's said that the African ones were trying to kill elephants and trying to kill rhinos and huge big things, giraffes, whereas your ones in Asia were trying to hit antelope and deer and things like that. And they didn't have to be so big. So your ones got small and became like cats. Is there any, do you see that model as having any validity?
I guess it's, you know, environmental pressure would lead to those that natural selection, you know, smaller animals. You know, the same you would have with the difference between Asian elephants and African elephants, where Asian elephants are notably smaller, living in forests rather than African elephants living out in open plains. You'd have something fairly similar with the lions, and then keeping tab on a big pride in the forest, which could be fairly dense anyway. I think it works probably best for them to live in small families. So we have a male or two, and then three or four females that would follow with the cubs.
Are they safer things to be around? I've told that they are the most docile of lions to human beings. They are far less likely to be hit by an Asiatic lion than an African one because they're much gentler. They don't go for such big prey as us, I suppose. Is there any truth in that?
I wouldn't chance it, regardless. I would personally treat both species the exact same anyway. I think there is the same problem. With the wild population, you could have obviously differences with the Asian probably targeting smaller prey than the Africans. But, you know, in a captive situation, I wouldn't chance it.
But as Richard was saying about the African lions, and I've seen them in Africa, the females, the pride, do all the hunting and the male then sashes up and has a go himself. In the case of the Asiatic lions, is it the same? Do the females do all the hunting and the male then swans up to get his dinner, or does he hunt for his own food? Is the behaviour different in the Asian lions than it is in the African lions?
I think it's fairly similar behaviours. I think the Asian Asiatic lions would be probably a bit more opportunistic as well. Again, living in those dense planted forests. So I'm sure a male would come across a prey, in an ambush. He would take it and not leave it to the girls.
All right. Well, it's good news for the park. So Julian and Terry, thank you very much indeed. Now let's say hello to Bernadette Murphy in Carlow, who sent in a wonderful email. Hello, Bernadette.
Hello, Derek. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Now, there are two crab spiders featured in this email. Tell us more.
OK. I sent you in a photograph of two crab spiders on an oxeye daisy in my garden. And one was coloured white and the other was yellow. And the crab spiders have the ability to change colour to camouflage themselves when they're hunting for their prey. And I was delighted to see both on the one oxeye daisy because I often see either a white one or a yellow one. Sometimes I see a yellow on one of the Arthur Bell roses or on different yellow flowers, but sometimes I see the white then on the oxeye daisies. But to see both together was nice. on the one flower. Is it rare to see both together on the one flower?
Aina, it's all yours.
Bernadette, this is a great description altogether of crab spiders. In fact, it's quite rare to see crab spiders at all. They seem to be a little bit more common this year. I'm getting more reports of them. But in general, people never see them because they do a great job at camouflaging themselves and not being seen. Now, the oxeye daisy you have it on is a big daisy. Some people call them American daisies because everything in America is bigger than it is here, you know. But anyway, the American or the oxeye daisy is large. Daisy with the yellow eye and the white petals. And what the crab spiders do is they camouflage. They're really sneaky when you think about it, or maybe they're very clever. They actually sit in the flower, and when a pollinating insect comes along and sticks its head in to get the free drink of nectar, it sticks it right into the mouth of the crab spider, who promptly stings it or puts its venom into it and kills it. And of course, this is very clever if you're approached by a bee, because most creatures don't eat bees because of their business end. But the crab spider isn't having anything to do with the business end of a bee, because it's the head of a bee that it sticks its fangs into and poisons. So it is a real sneaky operation altogether. And as you say, they're different colours depending on the colour of the flowers. And indeed, they can be pink sometimes as well. And they can change. Now, I wonder, I mean, the two that you have, were they busy changing and they haven't changed yet? Or had they just been blown out of it by the wind or something? The thing shook and they fell out. But normally you'd only get one in an oxeye daisy at a time. That's my flower. I get the bees here. You go off to your flower. So to see the two on the one flower is interesting, because if they're obvious like this, because they're on the wrong colours, any self-respecting pollinating insect will see them and give them a wide berth.
A few weeks prior to this, I had seen a similar a white and a yellow one in Altamont Gardens in County Carlow. And it just was a few weeks before this photograph here. But it was very similar, like there was two spiders on the one oxeye daisy as well there.
There seems to be a lot of them around this year and people are noticing them more. I get pictures too of bees who have been caught by the spider, and there has the spider stuck its fangs in. The bee is dead. And then, of course, what the spider will do then is suck the insides out of it. You haven't seen any successful operations when there are two of them. They don't seem to work as a team. It seems to be quite the opposite, because normally spiders will kill each other. So to see the two of them there is very interesting. Now, I haven't come across that before, so it'll be interesting to see if you catch them actually killing anything.
Now, last year I saw quite a few in my own garden, and also in Altamont Gardens in County Carlow, say a white one on the oxeye daisies with its prey, like it had caught its prey.
Yeah, there was only one there and it was able to manage it. And I don't know if they're getting more common or people are just paying more attention to flowers, because people are now saying to me, oh, is this going to destroy the bees and will we have no more bees left because of these spiders? But I don't think they're causing depredation on that large of a scale, really. I mean, the spiders are quite small relative to the size of the bee. So if you killed one, you'd imagine that would give you enough food to keep you going for a fortnight. So they're hardly going to cause depredation on bee colonies.
The funny thing is, I don't think they're on the daisy anymore, the two that I've seen. I've seen other whites and yellows, but I haven't seen it since on the same daisy. There's so many daisies, it's hard to know which daisy it was, but I don't see two together anymore on a daisy. So whether one just flew across or crawled across, I don't know.
It's great, isn't it? I mean, rather than saying, oh, there's a bunch of boring daisies, you'd be inspecting them, looking for crab spiders in them, seeing what they're doing. There's always something very interesting to see, even among a stand of daisies. So keep up the good work. You're doing a great job.
Thank you, Aina. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, Bernadette. And that's pretty much all we have time for tonight. My thanks to Aina Nilana, Matthew Jebb, Colin McLaughlin and Richard Collins, our broadcast coordinator Daniel Keating and our researcher Michelle Brown. Don't forget to visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We'll do it all again at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.